your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome once more to Sophomore Lit, where we're in the midst of our fall fundraiser. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning guest host, Shannon Camp.
Hi, I'm so excited to be back.
Hi, will you remind everyone who you are?
I'm Shannon Camp, and I'm a Chicago-based actor slash writer slash podcast person now, I guess. And I was last on the Wuthering Heights episode, and I've also had the pleasure of doing a few voiceovers for the show. So, I'm a big Sophomore Lit fan.
This time, we are doing Robert Cormier's The Chocolate War. I believe his name is pronounced Robert Cormier. I was trying to find out whether it was Cormier or Cormier or Cormier, and I've heard it pronounced every which way, so I'm going to stick with Cormier because it sounds like what people from Boston would say. And he did live near Boston. He lived in Fitchburg. This book has an odd history with me. When I was in sixth grade, I was taken aside by a well-meaning teacher who thought I wasn't getting enough stimulation in my class, and she handed me a book called I Am the Cheese, which is not The Chocolate War, but is also by Robert Cormier. And she said, John, why don't you read this book? And I read the book, and it destroyed me. It was a miserably bleak, horrific book, and it was kind of a little old for me at the time, but I was fascinated by the fact that a book could be that depressing. And after that, I spent about 4 months getting over it, and then I started to look for other books by Robert Cormier, and I read The Chocolate War, which is his most famous and probably most assigned book, and was utterly destroyed by that as well. And I then read the sequel, Beyond the Chocolate War, which we won't get into here because I can't remember anything about it except that it was probably just as depressing. And I finally read his book, After the First Death, which I cannot recommend in good conscience to anyone if you want to ever have another happy day in your life. So that's my history with the book.
Sad boy John McCoy.
You didn't read this book when you were in high school, right?
No. Okay. So I actually am kind of lacking in the genre of like books about angsty young men, if you can believe it, because you want to talk about being challenged by depressing books. So, and also being a huge fucking nerd, I was one of 8 kids in the entire school that was in this special advanced reading program. There was 4 boys and 4 girls, and they put us in this kind of separate program all by ourselves for 2 class periods a day. So while the rest of the school read The Outsiders, which is a very well-known book for young adults, we read I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and Night by Elie Wiesel, which is, you know, a book about living through a concentration camp. So, this book would have seemed downright cheerful compared to what I was reading in junior high. But no, I had not read it until I read it for the podcast.
I overheard you on another podcast, on the Boy Next Door podcast called The Cast Next Door, in which you had mentioned to your co-host at that time that you loved scenes of male aggression. And so I thought immediately of this book, and I thought, well, I should put Shannon through that.
I don't remember that, but in fairness to myself, I was extremely hungover when I recorded that episode of The Cast Next Door. But I will say I went into this book with pretty low expectations because I had heard it compared to A Separate Piece, which is a book that I genuinely dislike. And so I wasn't super thrilled. And also, I did eventually go back and read The Outsiders so that I would be less of an outsider. And I wasn't necessarily the biggest fan of that either, just because it was a little bit teeny bopperish for me, I think. But I really liked this book a lot. I won't say that the experience of reading it was pleasant, because it filled me with an overwhelming sense of dread at every turn. I think part of the reason I read the book practically in one sitting, almost right after you assigned it to me, if you will. And I think it was just because I felt the urge to press forward and to see what would happen, because I had so much anxiety about how it was going to turn out. And, well, all my worst fears were fulfilled.
When I read this book as a teenager, I'll have to say that one of the things that happened was I became convinced that this was what private school was like. And particularly, I became convinced that this was a Catholic private school was like. And then flash forward many years to my own kids going to private school, and my wife trying to convince me, no, it would be fine, that they were going to be fine. And all I could think about was this book. Cormier was a journalist, actually. He was born in Leominster, Massachusetts, which is also close to Boston. And he worked most of his life in Fitchburg. And one of the things that I found interesting was when I was looking up, trying to find out the way his name was pronounced, I came across a YouTube video that had reminiscences of him by his children. And it's fascinating to me that he left full-time work in the newspaper when his kids were born to become a stay-at-home dad. And this was back in the late 60s, before this was a thing that men did. And he chose his career of writing books for young adults because he wanted to have a career where he could stay at home and take care of the kids. And he said in an interview that he thought of himself as primarily a husband and secondarily a father, and a distant third, he thought of himself as a novelist, which just completely blew me away, because all of his books are so depressing and so...
Well, I love that. Obviously, he sounds like he was a really good dude. Not to be reductive, a good dude. But I think that's interesting. Just, I wouldn't have predicted that, because the only parent that we really see in this novel is Jerry's father, and he's kind of emotionally distant most of the time. They have sort of that brief moment of connection we hear about at the mother's funeral, but other than that, it seems like they don't really... Not just they don't communicate with each other, they hardly interact with each other, and then we barely even see any other parents in the course of the book. So that's really interesting, because this feels like a world where, you know, we have the teachers are the ultimate authority, and then we have kind of the various hierarchies of students, but not a lot of parents factor into it, whereas it seems he was actually a really involved parent.
Apparently, this book was written after his son decided he didn't want to sell chocolates at the private school that he was going to. And apparently Robert Cormier agreed with his son and said, sure. And they took the chocolates that his son was supposed to sell back to the school and returned them, saying, no, we're not going to do this. And then he turned around and wrote this novel. And I can't help but wonder what the school thought about the whole thing.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's a doozy. I don't know what to add to that.
Enough background. Let's get into the story here. It doesn't really have a very complicated story, which is good, because then we can kind of focus on what I think this book is more about. It's about these moments, these sort of character moments. So this takes place in a private Catholic school called Trinity. That's not a real school. It's not a real place, but it is kind of based on the kind of private school that was common in Boston in the 50s and 60s. And we follow our hero. His name is Jerry Renault. And as you mentioned, he is a young man whose mother has recently died just the year before he enters the school. And so he's new at the school, and he's trying to fit in, and he's very depressed. And he's trying to make his way in a rather imposing and disturbing school. This is a book that's almost entirely about boys and men. and about male problems. Jerry literally seems to have a sort of a Madonna whore complex because the only women he thinks about are his mom, his poor dead mom, and then about women that he sees as being sexually attracted to, either in pornography or this girl he sees on the bus. Was that off-putting to you to read a book that was so male?
I kind of knew what I was getting into going in, so that was definitely part of it. This world didn't feel that foreign to me because I grew up almost exclusively with boys. Growing up, all our family friends had boys my age and boys my brother's age, so it was just kind of like a lot of guys, so I kind of always had to elbow my way into the conversation, and I could kind of elbow my way into the prose of this book. You know, it's interesting. I don't know if it's too soon to talk about this, but the whole idea of the social machinations and these Machiavellian schemes, that is very female to me. And actually, I was reading about this book and about some of the controversy surrounding it and how it's been banned by schools in the past. And I could easily think of many books about young women this same age and how they psychologically torture each other that have never caused any controversy, because I think people kind of expect girls to do that to each other. It's only the element of physical violence that sets it apart from what girls do to each other. But the scheming and the mental tricks, no, that all felt very familiar. Even though the characters may have been boys, they were boys that I could have known in real life, and some of their social dynamics struck me as very female.
Well, the one thing that I do apologize about, I forgot that this book had such a hang-up on masturbation. There's so many segments in here where the boys talk about jerking off, and I do apologize for that.
Oh, please. I mean, you heard me on the cast next door talking about flicking beans and stuff. It's going to take a lot more than that to shock me.
So to get to the story here, Jerry comes to Trinity. He is trying out for football. He just barely makes it onto the team. And we are introduced to the powers that be at this school, which include the brothers that run the school. We aren't ever really told what religious order runs the school. The head guy is this guy, Brother Leon. He's actually the vice principal, but the principal is in the hospital. And so Leon is taking over, and he has this great plan to financially revitalize the school by upping the chocolate sale this year. Did you have chocolate sales in your high school?
No, the closest I ever came was selling Girl Scout cookies, and believe you me, it was a lot less cutthroat than this. I went to public school. I went to Catholic, like, religious education on the weekends, but obviously there's no comparison there. So, I mean, I have a little bit of frame of references to the Catholic stuff. I think the character of the cruel slash semi-sadistic teacher, though, always finds a way to, you know, work its way under my skin. It's a really disturbing trope, and kind of no matter how many times I see it, I don't really ever get over it. This guy was giving me like some major Dolores Umbridge from Harry Potter feelings in terms of whenever he appeared in the book, like my revulsion was so strong. I almost like couldn't wait to get through his scenes and like just get past it until he was gone again, because he's so, so horrible to read about. Just like awful.
When I read this book as a kid, this book struck me as relentlessly realistic. I never read a book that where I felt like the characters were so credible. But reading it through this time, I see them more as broadly painted. And Brother Leon seems to be very broadly painted as a villain. I mean, he's believable, but he is also you're supposed to hate him.
Yeah. I mean, I love teachers and I support teachers and I teach kids now after school as part of an arts program. But I believe that cruel teachers and manipulative teachers can exist. At the same time, Brother Leon is inarguably painted in broad strokes. So right. There is that.
So he has this plan. He's going to have all the students sell 50 boxes of these chocolates that he's gotten at a cut rate because they were Mother's Day chocolates.
Yeah. And then he's marking them up on top of the fact that he's making them all sell more than usual. He's marking up the price to twice what it used to be.
Now, we've also been introduced by this point to the sort of secret society that runs the place called the Vigils, which is a band of students who run everything behind the scenes. They're kind of fraternal order that mostly is involved in doing pranks and mischief around the school. But they have enough power that Brother Leon knows of them and wants to get them on his side. He contacts the other main character of the book, Archie, who works for the Vigils as the what's his title is the assigner or the
I think it is like just the assigner because Obi is the secretary and then there's someone who's like I think Carter is like the enforcer. He's the one who's in charge of like the physical violence aspect.
Carter is actually the president, which is kind of
okay,
interesting.
Okay, he's the president.
Yeah, he is also much stronger than Archie. But Archie arguably is the person who really runs everything because his job is to come up with these assignments, which is a kind of an initiation that the students have to go through, where if you're called by the Vigils, you have to do the assignment you're given, and it's typically a prank that if you are caught is an expellable offense. And the idea is that everybody in turn is going to do something for the Vigils and kind of be blackmailed into having to keep the Vigils' secrets and keep on the side of the Vigils, because it's kind of a mutually assured destruction. If anyone ever got caught, they'd all be in trouble.
What is really fascinating and what really the part of the assignments process that really hooked me was the black box.
Right.
Like, this was fascinating to me. So there's kind of a kangaroo court aspect, I guess you could almost call it, where the boys are at least given the illusion of the chance that, oh, you might have a chance to escape this. There's a box with, I want to say, 6 marbles in it.
Yeah, that's right.
6. 5 are white, 1 is black. And after Archie gives you the assignment that he creates, and he really has a gift for coming up with these things, he has to draw a marble himself out of the box. If he draws white, then you have to do the assignment. But if he draws the one black marble, then he has to do it. But in the 3 years that he's been assigning these tasks, he's never drawn the black marble, which was interesting.
So the example we're given at the beginning of the book, a character named Roland Goobert, who's basically called the Goober through the book.
Yeah, or the Goob.
The Goob is assigned the task of loosening all the screws in Brother Eugene's classroom. And these are these old-fashioned desks that are bolted to the floor and chairs that are all metal and wood. And so the Goob has to spend the entire night in the room, first with the Vigils outside, making sure no one's going to come in and disturb him. Eventually, as it becomes clear that he's not going to make it through the night, they actually come in and aid him, and they succeed in loosening every screw in this room, so the next day when they come in, the room falls apart, which results in...
It explodes.
It explodes.
They describe it as it comes apart in 19 seconds, so it feels like an explosion, almost like kind of like dominoes falling down is how I pictured it.
It leads to Brother Eugene having a nervous breakdown. You know, if this were like a movie from the 90s, you know, you'd expect to see some sort of wild outlandish thing that the kids all did where they came in and they, you know, bolted all the furniture to the ceiling and everyone would go, uh-oh, crazy stuff. But this actually has repercussions. It actually ends up costing the school a lot of money and costing Brother Eugene his peace of mind.
Yeah, well, before we go any further, I was hoping we could talk about Archie a little bit
more. Sure, let's talk about Archie.
He's a really, really, really compelling character. And he actually struck me as one of the most realistic characters in the book, even though he is a sociopath or perhaps a psychopath who's kind of, for the most part, as far as we can tell, as far as even his kind of closest companion, Obi, his errand boy, can gauge, he's without real empathy or feelings, it seems. But I totally believe that a person like this could exist. This character conjured up memories for me of this kid who I knew in high school who was very good at saying things in front of everyone, even in front of teachers, that were sort of innocuous, but he would say them in such a way that you knew it was a taunt, but he never did it overtly enough for the teacher to be able to say anything, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
Like, he would say something that, in a different context, it might have been totally a bland thing, but he would say it in such a way that you knew that you were the target of mockery, and all the other students knew it, even the teacher knew. But there was nothing the teacher could really do because the teacher couldn't yell at this kid for saying what seemed to be a somewhat innocuous statement. I'm trying to think of a good example of some of the stuff he would say, but it's hard because it really all was pretty mundane. But it was one of those things where when he kind of fixed his stare on you, you knew that you were about to be the subject of the mockery of your classmates. And so as soon as I started reading about Archie, I started picturing this person as that character, and he was very vivid to me.
Well, I think it's interesting you say that Archie completely lacks empathy, because I agree, except there was also that one point where Obi says, from time to time, Archie would show these glimmers of psychological acuity, and after Archie decides that he's going to give Jerry an assignment, he seems genuinely concerned about Jerry's mother in a way that Obi is trying to figure out whether he's being put on or whether he actually cares about Jerry in any way. I think one of the things that Archie strikes me as is a guy who has this incredibly intuitive ability to read people psychologically.
Yeah.
Without.
Oh, yeah, because he gets Brother Leon's number, like, immediately.
Right. When Leon calls Archie into his office and says that he needs his help with the chocolate drive, Archie immediately can see that Leon is worried, and he can see that there's a problem here. And it later comes out that Brother Leon has overstepped his role and bought these chocolates without the authority. He's stepping outside of his financial bounds here and spent a lot of the school's money, and he has to make this back or he's going to be in trouble. But Archie immediately can see that Leon is in trouble. He can immediately see that Leon needs him, and he's fascinated by that. There's this kind of a sense that Archie is discovering things as he goes along, and he's always excited when he discovers something about someone else's weakness. Yeah, I agree that Archie is the most fascinating character of the book, and I would say that the scenes between him and Obi, the secretary, where Obi plays this kind of a straight man who's disgusted with the lengths to which Archie puts people through, those are some of the best written scenes of the book.
Oh, totally. I mean, maybe I misspoke. I wouldn't say Archie is totally incapable of empathy, but I would say he rarely, when he does feel those empathetic feelings, he rarely chooses to act on them in any way, even when he kind of can read the situation. And I liked that he kind of knew that Obi resented him and would get knocked down and vow revenge, but he would also be the sort of kid who would never have the wherewithal to actually make revenge happen. So there was an interest. That was, yeah, I agree. Definitely an interesting dynamic there. I thought watching Archie have this kind of supreme confidence in himself that is sort of rare in that age, because it is an age when kids are insecure, but you also feel at the same time like you're very immortal. And the whole process of drawing the marble from the black box and him being like, oh, I'm Archie, I can't fail. And then through the book, watching him have these kind of troubles within the vigils and actually like coming up against an opponent in Brother Leon who like offers real opposition, and having that confidence shaken a little bit was really, really interesting.
Jerry is given an assignment by the vigils. We aren't told what it is at first, but we see the effect of it, which is when the chocolates are being given out for sale, Brother Leon has an assembly every morning where he asks the students how many boxes they want to take to sell that day. And when they get to Jerry's name, he says none. He doesn't want to take any. And this sets up the sort of the major conflict of the book. It will emerge that this was his assignment. And if you've been paying attention, you probably guessed that was his assignment. But it's kind of not stated directly. And this becomes a recurring scene in the book. These morning assemblies where Leon calls out everyone's name. And when we get to Jerry, Jerry refuses the chocolates, and he's forced to go through this day in and day out. And it's an interesting and I think effective description of what conformity and peer pressure looks like, because it's brutal.
Yeah, to say the least. I mean, just reading this book gave me such incredible anxiety. I can't even tell you, like, the nervousness I felt with each turn of the page. Yeah, and the author does a great job of bringing that in, because it is palpable and it gets very tense. I would also like to touch on another character who comes into kind of, he comes into the story first through his interactions with Archie, and that's Emil. What's his last name?
Oh, right. Emil,
They usually refer to him by his last name, but for some reason I remembered Emil. Quick
Janza.
To the Wikipedia.
Emil Janza.
Janza. Okay. He is like Archie in some ways, but kind of lacking his cleverness or subtlety. He's a bully with more of a passion for the physical violence. And he also does this thing where he'll sit in the front row of a classroom and do like lots of innocuous little obnoxious things to kind of slowly drive the teacher insane, which, just like the person I was talking about before, I definitely saw kids do this, so like this struck me as a very realistic thing. But one of the things I really want to talk about with Emil, especially because the book is so, you know, there is a lot of talk about like girls and women as sort of sexual objects, and there is some masturbation, but like not as much as you might think. But a lot of times when the sexuality
that's your recommendation. Shannon Camp says not as much masturbation as you would think.
I mean, you know, it's a lot of high school boys, and I've read books and seen plays that had way worse in it. For example, the German play Spring Awakening, which is a favorite of mine. But anyway, a lot of times when the sexuality comes into the story, it is through Emil, who's kind of described as almost a more animalistic character than the other boys. But I was curious if you thought he was coded as a closeted homosexual, because I got that vibe from him sometimes, and I wasn't sure how much of that was the author's intention and how much of was that me perhaps reading into it, because he talks about kind of getting horny when he's beating guys up on the football field more than he needs to. He attacks Jerry by accusing him of being queer, although we later find out that was Archie's idea. So, and then there are a couple other little moments. And I was just, you know, there's that trope of, oh, the homophobic bully is actually gay himself. And I was wondering if you picked up on that here.
I thought that was kind of there. This book was written in 1974. And it does, I think, realistically describe the gay panic that boys, you know, had then, still have now. Oh
yeah, and like I see it to this day.
And so some of the stuff having to do with homosexuality is kind of through that veil of how much you could talk about at that point. And I agree, mm-hmm. though. I think Emil is either closeted or he's simply a sadist. But you're right to point out that he...
It could be both. Yeah. It could be both.
And Emil is being blackmailed by Archie because he believes that Archie has a photograph of him masturbating. In this world, everybody has some power over somebody else, and quite often it has to do with sex and desire. Emil is certainly physically more imposing and threatening than anyone in the book, but
he's small. That's what's interesting. He's not even a big guy. He's quite small.
As time goes on, Leon consults with Obi to find out what's going on with Jerry, and Obi...
it's Corcoran. It's Corcoran. Bobby Corcoran, I think his name is.
Oh, right. Bobby Corcoran. Sorry. Yes. Bobby Corcoran.
Who's Bobby Corcoran has been drafted into becoming Leon's accountant and keeping track of all the boxes of chocolates and tallying up the numbers. And he becomes aware that Leon is fudging the numbers for the announcements to the school, too.
Corcoran is an interesting character because he's, in a way, he doesn't really have any influence over the events of the story, but he emerges as a guy who kind of pieces everything together. He figures out what's going on with Leon. He later figures out that there's something very fishy going on with the numbers, with this whole the whole chocolate sales. But he's in a position where he doesn't have anything he can do. I mean, one of the things that happens in this is a lot of characters find themselves with no good
recourse,
no good choices.
Yeah, the Goober is another good example of that. You know, I feel for this kid. He's absolutely tortured by his guilt over what he did to brother Eugene, even though I kind of agree with, I think it's Jerry who says, well, he must have kind of been on the verge of a nervous breakdown anyway, if this one incident can push him over the edge, because it's definitely an obnoxious and an expensive prank, but it's not particularly a dangerous or malicious prank, if you ask me. I mean, maybe I'm coming at that from a perspective of a young person. I don't know. But the poor Goober is just absolutely distraught over having had a hand in this guy's downfall. And yeah, I would say him and Bobby Corcoran kind of struck me as the two characters who are really swept along in the tide of events. And they're kind of just trying to tread water and keep their heads above the current.
In the meantime, Jerry is being, is still painted as a guy who seems disconnected from his own life. He certainly, the loss of his mother has left him very empty. And he's obsessed with female company, but he has no idea about how to go about doing that. There's a girl on a bus that he loves from afar. He discovers her name, and he gets the bright idea that he's just going to call everyone with that name in the phone book. And he calls up. He finally gets this girl on the phone, and it plays out about as well as you might think it would.
Well, okay, this, maybe more than any other, this scene made me roll my eyes and be like, oh, man, even though that's honestly not how I felt for the majority of the book. I didn't feel alienated by the sex or gender stuff because, you know, it's coming from a very specific perspective, and I appreciate that the author, you know, realistically portrayed that perspective. But he calls this girl, and basically what we get from their conversation is she already has a boyfriend. And that, to him, is just appalling. And I was like, go fuck yourself. I mean, I liked Jerry. I was rooting for him. And I was actually kind of horrified by the end of what happened to him in the book because I really thought that at some point the other shoe was bound to drop. But him getting just so angry at her for not wanting to talk to a stranger on the phone and then for already having a young man in her life was just like, you're not living in the real world, dude.
To be fair, I don't think that Cormier wants us to think that what Jerry is doing is well-advised.
No, no. Yeah, I agree with you.
As you mentioned, when Leon discovers that Jerry has been told not to sell chocolates as his assignment for the vigils. He becomes a lot happier, and the word gets out around school, and there's kind of a tension gets broken around the school because everyone's been wondering what the hell's going on. Everyone's been feeling very nervous and innervated about the whole thing, because even though Jerry has been bearing the brunt of it, it's created a kind of a feeling of tension and upset throughout the whole school, and everyone
expects... You could even say Jerry has disturbed the universe, perhaps.
Yes. Well, that comes up. You want to bring that up here?
Yeah, he has this poster in his locker which has a line from actually one of my favorite poems. I know it's not a very original favorite poem to have, whatever, I'm not a fucking hipster. That's the Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot. And it's that line, "Do I dare disturb the universe?" And I actually thought it was a really interesting choice here just because I've always associated that poem with feelings of romantic love, which is something that's honestly not really an element in this story. So I liked how it was kind of co-opted into this new context, and I thought it worked immensely well, and I really, really liked it.
Well, yeah, it is an interesting choice. For me, the thing that I thought was funny about it is that it was on a poster as a sort of an inspirational poster in Jerry's locker. You know, it shows this guy looking off into the horizon.
Yeah, that is pretty funny.
It's supposed to be this like inspirational poster, and it reminded me of Steve Jobs had a line. He said that his goal, the goal of life was to reach out and put a ding in the universe, and it kind of reminds me of all these kinds of big, grandiose, motivational sayings about asserting oneself.
Well, I think, like Steve Jobs, T.S. Eliot was also a bit of an asshole, so that follows.
Right, but the thing you have to remember about the actual Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock is it's written about an indecisive, nebbishy guy.
An older man, too,
who's beaten down by life, who wants to confess love to someone else and ends up not doing so at the end of the poem. Ultimately, is kind of trampled down by life.
Well, we'll get there.
Exactly. So it's, as I suspect you do, I always love it when characters in books or read poems, because that's always the author giving you a clue about how to take the...
Oh, yeah. If I were Emil Janza, I would be in the bathroom stall whacking it to literary references for sure.
When it comes time for Jerry's assignment to be over, he's supposed to have refused the chocolates for, 2 weeks, something like that?
10 days.
10 days. For 10 days, everyone is feeling really excited and relieved, and they're like, oh, now it's going to come around, and he's going to join in with the chocolate sales, and everything will be right in the world. But he refuses, and he surprises everyone in the classroom, including himself. He's not exactly sure why, after the fact, why he did this, but... You know, that's a hard thing to pull off from a writing standpoint, to write a character who isn't clear on their own motives. I think Cormier does a good job of writing about his internal confusion. One thing I'd like to point out here is that the book is written, you know, in third person, but it does take this strategy of having each of these many, many, I think there's like 40 chapters in this book, short little chapters, being written from the point of view of one of the character or another, and it keeps shifting around, so we actually get to see each person in time.
I thought it was really interesting. We even got some chapters from classmates who are like extremely minor characters. Like we have the two boys who have the conversation on the phone about how like fundraising is a pain in the ass, and I'm like, yeah, dog, for sure. But they're like not major characters at all. They're just kind of giving us the flavor of like the everyman, the man on the street, which I liked. Like, I loved what a wide scope we got. I thought it was fascinating. We even got interior monologues from characters like Emil, kind of. I thought what really was a running thread through all these perspectives was like the profound loneliness of being a teenage boy. Like, even characters like Emil and Archie ended up having moments where they felt hurt that they weren't being understood or that they weren't being appreciated or they weren't getting recognition or sympathy and stuff like that. So I thought Cormier did a really good job of kind of structuring that in such a way that I felt like I really understood who everyone at the school was and how they fit into the social pecking order.
At first, the school kind of rallies behind Jerry. All the students start saying, yeah, that's go Jerry. You know, these fundraisers are bullshit. And why doesn't everybody refuse? And he kind of becomes a folk hero around the school until Leon calls Archie into his office. He accuses Archie at first of setting this whole thing up. Archie protests that he had nothing to do with Jerry's continued refusal. And then Leon plays to Archie's sense of power and control, saying, well, at this point, Jerry is defying you as much as he's defying me.
This is fascinating because this is where the tide really turns. And it basically turns entirely through Archie's ability to kind of be like a PR agent. He spins it because he has all the boys are rooting for Jerry and kind of against the status quo. And Archie, pretty much through the power of influence and persuasion and the way he frames what's happening, manages to get them all to do a complete 180 and turn against Jerry as being like a traitor to their brotherhood, if you want to put it that way, the student body in general.
Right. So there are some bad scenes here for Jerry. His locker is broken into and his T.S. Eliot poster is defaced. And his shoes get torn up. As this is all happening, there is also internal strife in the vigils. At this point, Carter, the president of the vigils, is squabbling with Archie, and there's a kind of a control, a wrestling for control here. And he accuses Archie of having let this all get away from him. So everything is kind of falling apart, but what really starts to fall apart is in these morning roll calls where Brother Leon is asking each student how many chocolate boxes they will take. The people start asking out loud in class, why isn't Jerry selling it? We're all selling chocolates. Why isn't he involved?
After Archie decides that he's going to get everyone to turn against Jerry, things escalate really quickly. Like, I was reading it on Kindle, and I think Archie and Brother Leon's meeting happens at, like, 75% of the way through the book. And then from there on, like, that's, you know, we draw very close to the conclusion. Archie gets Emil. He asks Emil to accuse Jerry of being a homosexual and then to beat him up because he says the way to get someone really off their guard is to accuse them of something that they didn't do. Because if you accuse them of something they did, you're just telling them something they already know. But Emil, kind of against Archie's wishes, ends up taking it even further by getting like a group of street kids from his neighborhood to come with him. And they gang up on Jerry and beat him until he's, like, basically unconscious and he imagines, like, his mother standing over him and singing. It's really, really upsetting. Honestly, from here to the end of the book, it was a struggle just to, like, push through to the end.
The concluding sequence happens when
it becomes the Hunger Games at the end.
Yes. Now, Archie has, again, because Archie's a great manipulator of people, he realizes that at this point he can maneuver Jerry into a all-out fight what's his name again?
Janza. Emil Janza.
Yes, with Janza. He's going to have a fight with Janza because he calls up Jerry and offers it as a chance to regain face, to fight back in front of the entire school. And he knows that this is something Jerry will risk anything to get. And so Jansa is pretty easy to maneuver into a fight because Jansa just wants to fight anyway. And what they do is they get Jansa and Jerry are going to show up at this sort of under the lights out in an athletic field outside the school in the dark of night, and they're going to have a boxing match. But the boxing match is going to take place under Archie's rules, which are everyone in the school gets to join in a lottery where they get to pay to put slips into a box, and each of those slips has on it a hit that one of the boys will do to the other one. So each one will be called out in turn. And one of the things that's also fascinating at this point is that through Archie's machinations, the chocolate sales have gone up again. They've gone through the roof, and they have sold every box except for the 50 boxes that Jerry was supposed to sell. And so those 50 boxes are also brought out onto the field as a prize, I guess, for whoever wins.
It's didn't really understand what they were going to do with those chocolates. At this point, though, like, it's hard to overstate how disturbing this part of the book is. Like, this is where we go from a separate piece to the Lord of the Flies. Like, right. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's really, really hard to read about, like, kids watching and doing and relishing this physical violence on each other. And, you know, I know that it happens. This is something that, even with all my years of growing up with boys, I can't pretend to have experienced anything even remotely in the realm of this. I'm happy to say that. Very happy to say that. So, yeah, I mean, this is brutal. And basically, you know, Jerry gets beaten to a pulp. Brother Jacques, who's a kind of background teacher, comes and tries to shut the whole thing down by shutting off the power grid to the football field where they're fighting, and ends up kind of, in the ensuing confusion, causing kind of a mini riot. And the whole time the fight is going on, Archie is aware that Brother Leon is watching and purposely not intervening.
Brother Leon is watching from across the field and
probably masturbating, honestly, knowing this book.
Probably. But the
can that be our hashtag for this episode? Hashtag probably masturbating.
The fight is it is brutal, but it's well described. Almost all the strikes are against Jerry. Jerry does get a chance to fight back, and he connects, and he thinks he's going to win, but the crowd is so against him, they're booing him and very angry with him, and Emil gets he gets an illegal hit, a hit to the groin, which was supposed to be off the books, but of course, Emil doesn't care.
One of the things when we are, I think in Emil's first appearance, they say that, like, he's small, but he'll always win in a fight because he's, like, crazy and he'll fight super dirty. So that wasn't a huge surprise. I think that Jerry had a chance in this fight the way that every kid who gets an assignment has a chance when Archie reaches his hand into that box and is, you know, he might pull out a black marble.
Oh, right. Actually, that's an interesting point, because one of the things that happens before this fight is Carter, the president of the Vigils, points out to Archie that he has to go through the marble ritual for both contestants in this case. First of all, he wants to break Archie's stranglehold over the Vigils. He would like to see Archie actually have to get into the fight, but either way, he wants to see Archie squirm and show fear in front of the school to kind of break the magic he has over the school. And Archie is having none of it. He just shoots his hand into the box, pulls out a white marble both times. And it makes
his
you kind of wonder.
His hands are shaking, but he conceals it. But his hands are trembling.
It makes you kind of wonder if he's been palming these marbles the whole time.
His whole I am Archie motif is very, very fascinating to me. So all the stuff between him and Carter was really interesting because we do think of him as top dog, and it's technically he's not. Oh, here's what I wanted to say. It was fascinating to me how all the characters would unquestioningly follow the rules of this secret society.
We do have a quote with a special guest.
Oh, a celebrity guest, I believe.
A celebrity guest that is the sequence with Carter talking to Archie about how he's manipulated the entire school to be involved in this whole project.
"I don't know how you do it, Archie," Carter was forced to admit. "Simple, Carter. Simple." Archie reveled in the moment, basking in Carter's admiration. Carter, who had humiliated him at the vigils meeting. Someday he'd get even with Carter, but at the moment, it was satisfying enough to have Carter regarding him with awe and envy. "You see, Carter, people are two things, greedy and cruel. So we have a perfect setup here. The greed part, a kid pays a buck for a chance to win 100, plus 50 boxes of chocolates. The cruel part, watching two guys hitting each other, maybe hurting each other while they're safe in the bleachers. That's why it works, Carter. Because we're all bastards." Carter disguised his disgust. Archie repelled him in many ways, but most of all, by the way he made everybody feel dirty, contaminated, polluted, as if there was no goodness at all in the world. And yet Carter had to admit that he was looking forward to the fight, that he himself had bought not one, but two tickets. Did that make him like everybody else? Greedy and cruel, as Archie said? The question surprised him. Hell, he'd always thought of himself as one of the good guys.
This book doesn't have a lot of famous quotes, but the one quote that you'll see again and again is this one about, what is this? The people are greedy and, let me look at this quote here, because
It's called Sophomore Lit, not Sophomore Homework, guys, okay?
It is.
We did what we had to do to get here tonight.
What's
and we did nothing more. You won't see John and I selling any fucking chocolates, okay? Since there's kind of a lull, do you mind if I leave and masturbate?
No, go ahead.
You already said I could.
This is all getting edited the hell out.
You said you wanted me to be funny.
Why can't I find this quote? This was the one quote from the chocolate board.
It's adorable to watch old people try to use technology, isn't it, guys?
Yeah, here we go. So this is the famous quote from the book, is Archie's theory on human nature, where he says people are two things, greedy and cruel. It's not a great insight. Or it's not perfectly written, but it does give a good window into this world of this book in which everybody is kind of greedy or cruel. I mean, the only people with some decency are Jerry, who is kind of just zoned out through most of the book, and Goober, who is also so distraught by his own ineffectiveness. I mean, the one thing that I would say about reading these books, I remembered from my childhood when I read it again, that feeling that this was a really brutal world, and,
yeah,
and a really hard world, and you leave it kind of wondering, is this really the world that you live in, or is this just the it's being put in sharp relief for this book?
Yeah, because it's kind of this isolated society. I would say one thing that was missing from the world of the book that in my experience growing up with a lot of boys and, you know, having a brother and like seeing him interact with other guys his age, I know that being a teenager is a lonely experience, and it can be an isolating one. I would never dispute that, but there's not really very much male friendship in this book. But in my experience, boys this age can definitely have, like, close and, you know, really good and important friendships. So we see that a little bit with Jerry and Goober, but not that much. And that was something that struck me as kind of, like, missing from the world of the book, was boys actually having, like, genuine connections with each other, because I think that that does happen.
Would so, you think Archie and Obi had a wonderful relationship?
Oh, yeah, the dream. That's kind of like Mr. Burns and Smithers, but actually not as warm.
Right. Well, the book closes on a scene with Archie and Obi, where Obi is saying to Archie, someday you'll get yours, and Archie isn't believing it.
Why be scared of Obi? I mean, come on.
You know, this is not a book with a lot of laughs, but I kind of laughed at the end of the book, because it kind of reminded me in some ways as the dark side of, say, the end of Casablanca, where we're left with the two characters kind of wandering off into the future.
Slightly before that, the last time we see Jerry, Goober is kind of holding him, almost cradling him, and Jerry tells him that basically it was a mistake to try to disturb the universe. You know, the status will remain quo, which is the impression that everything in the book has given us. I don't think we're supposed to think that, like, Brother Jacques and the good teachers are going to be able to wrest control from Leon now that he's succeeded in his goal. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a very cynical person by nature, and I think that I have a more optimistic view of humans. That being said, American politics this year have given me the feeling that people are greedy and cruel in general. So the whole idea of things kind of continuing as they are with the establishment was depressing, but I couldn't exactly say that it struck me as entirely unrealistic.
It's a really good portrait of the way in which the status quo maintains its power, which is it can make things really, really uncomfortable for you if you decide to go outside the norm. It's a remarkable book for the way it takes such a trivial thing as a fundraising and turns it into this exploration of how people can make people so uncomfortable. You know, it's sort of like at every step of the way, Jerry is told, if you just, you know, sell the damn chocolates, everything will be better. Right now, as we enter the Christmas season and we're being told that, you know, Starbucks needs to put Merry Christmas on their cups, it just makes me think.
Sorry, that just escaped me all of a sudden.
It makes me think about all those little ways in life that you're just expected to toe the line.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this is a really good example with the chocolates and the cups of how something that is really, in essence, so small and so trivial can kind of grow magnified in someone's mind. We see it grow magnified in the mind of the individual first in Brother Leon, and then how this school, which is sort of its own little microcosm society, magnifies it in turn. So I agree with you. That's a totally phenomenon that can happen. I mean, I liked this book a lot. I like I said at the beginning of the podcast, it was not an enjoyable experience to read it. But I would still recommend it because I think it's really fascinating. And I think that Cormier has a really good hold on human interactions. I mean, he only chooses to show one side of that, which is the cruel and manipulative side. But that still totally has value. But like I said, at the same time, having read so many books about young women and for young women that didn't generate a fraction of the controversy that this book generated, although obviously some of them were not as famous, but I really think that if this were a book about girls and it didn't have the element of physical violence, people would not find the psychological machinations as surprising as they come off in this book.
Well, maybe, but one thing I would say is this book was published at a time when there wasn't a very clear genre of young adult fiction.
That's true.
It was kind of emerging. And who was writing at this time for women? It was Judy Blume was writing at this time for girls. And the one thing I would say about this is that Cormier got assigned in schools. Blume didn't get assigned much in schools.
No. And I mean, you could unpack that too for a number of gendered and non-gendered reasons, but that's another discussion for another day. If you ever want to do Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I'm your girl.
Well, okay. I was thinking I would go straight for Forever. Because that's the
At least that one we could get a lot of mileage out of discussing how the penis is a named character. Have you read Forever?
I have not read any Judy Blume, and I think it would serve me right to read Judy
Blume. Wait.
Blume.
Okay, sorry. I need to grill John on air now as if I am the brother Leon to his student. You never read any of the Fudge books, like Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, Super Fudge?
The Fudge books came out too late for me, so I didn't. Other people were reading them around me, but they were out around the time I was in middle school. So
that's such a Peter thing to say, right, guys? Sorry, yeah, John, you won't get that.
Well, I think I did like sneak a peek at Wifey when I was a teenager, so.
I'm just surprised you never read them with your kids, just because they're super funny. I'm actually reading the Super Fudge books to the kid that I nanny right now, because they're just really cute, even though there is a traumatizing turtle death in the first one, so you've been warned. But to backtrack a little bit, in Forever, the girl's boyfriend's penis is a character named Ralph. Her boyfriend's name is not Ralph. The penis is named Ralph. Guys, consider this a teaser for the Forever episode, because that's so real.
So guys, write us in. Tell us which Judy Blume book we should read. And
tell us what you named your penis.
Tell us what you named your penis in high school. And
tell us what you named your boyfriend's penis.
We've read a lot of serious fiction on sophomore lit. It's time to open it up to the world of young adult literature. So
this book has really thrown those doors wide open indeed, because... Yeah, I mean, I wonder what my reaction to this book would have been if I had read it as an actual, like, young teenager or read it in high school. Because I loved Lord of the Flies. I remember reading that my freshman year of high school and being like, this is so fucking edgy. But I bet I would have liked this too. It almost, like, I'm serious at the end with that raffle of punching moves. I was like, oh my God, Suzanne Collins is probably kicking herself for not finding a way to work this into one of the Hunger Games books. A raffle of punching moves. This is perfect.
Thanks again to my co-host, Shannon Camp. Shannon has her own new podcast, Stage of Fools, which is available at stageoffools.podomatic.com. Or you can look for it on iTunes. Thanks to my brother Dan, who has his own podcast you may have heard of, available at flophousepodcast.com or on iTunes. Finally, thanks to Malcolm Nygaard, who recorded a new theme song for Sophomore Lit. If you'd like to send me a theme song or outro music for the podcast, email me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. The Chocolate War is copyright 1974 by Robert Cormier. And as always, remember, everything will be on the final.